Okay, folks, you are in for a treat. I get to talk to Dr. Corey for nearly 2 hours about all things COVID. And specifically, we spend a lot of time on long haul COVID because he is not, even though he was trained as an intensivist in focusing on respiratory health in the ICU and really became very skilled in that area, he is now treating lots of people with long haul COVID. So we go into some of the details on that protocol specifically and what you use with ivermectin. He's written a new book, The War on Ivermectin. We talk a lot about that too and some of the challenges and with that pharma fraud and some of their other fraud is related to the COVID jab. So you're going to love it. Stay tuned and hope you enjoy it.
After my ivermectin testimony, right, which went viral, which brought a lot of attention to the FLCCC, our protocols were looked into, doctors started prescribing ivermectin. I literally thought that like we were providing a major intervention that would alter the trajectory of the pandemic without question. It would reduce cases and deaths and hospitalizations. And now you had an effective early outpatient treatment. And I thought that news would be welcome. What happened in the next few months is that like everything started going sideways and I could not figure it out. I saw hit pieces. I was literally bringing forth data supporting the efficacy of a generic drug. Now, that is poking the bear. And when we, you know, when I say poking the bear, what is anathema to the pharmaceutical industry and their whole business model is they cannot have generic off-patent drugs become standard of care. It obliterates the market for their pricey new pills. I didn't know I was stepping into a war. In the history of pharma, I don't think any single medicine threatened as many markets and campaigns in history. The only other medicine that did that was hydroxychloroquine, but they already killed hydroxychloroquine in 2020. Suddenly, the world made sense, and not in a good way. It was very ugly because I was like, that's what's going on. There's a massive disinformation campaign directed at ivermectin. And from that moment on, everything that happened every day, it was almost like I got pushed and tied to a front row seat for a horror movie. Literally, I had to watch a horror movie unfold ever since.
Welcome everyone, Dr. Mercola, helping you take control of your health. And today we are joined by one of the warriors in the fight against COVID misinformation and really a great sacrifice to himself personally, as we'll discuss in a moment. But this is Dr. Pierre Corey, who has a new book coming out on ivermectin, which really details many of the inside story of what happened with ivermectin and you know why it's essentially pharma was able to suppress it successfully. So welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Dr. McCullough. Really my pleasure to be here.
But before we go into the details, I'd like to talk a bit about your personal story and background. Sure. Maybe just the most curious one I think most people are interested in, and certainly me, it would be an update on what has happened to the campaign against you, not only you, but your associate, Dr. Paul Merrick, and Dr. Peter McCullough, who are all internists. You and Paul are critical care internists, and Peter is a cardiologist, but nevertheless still certified by the same board, which is the American Board of Internal Medicine. And I didn't realize until I had my interview with Peter that their attempt to essentially remove your credentials from that board really limits your ability to practice medicine. You know, as a family physician in private practice, it wouldn't. I mean, I'm not an internist. I'm boarded by the family practice boards, but if they removed my board, it wouldn't have anything to do with me practicing when I was still seeing patients. But apparently that's not the case for you. So I'm wondering if you can update us with the latest on their efforts to take away your certification.
Yeah. So your point is actually important, right? So, you know, when I first got served the letter and I could see they were coming after my board certification, I mean, board certifications historically were just a badge of distinction, right? It showed that you passed the higher level test and you had some sort of you know, higher level of knowledge. But, you know, the way the system works now, if you're not board certified, there's numerous academic medical centers that you cannot join their staff. Insurance companies will not put you on their panel. So for me, if I ever wanted to go back to critical care, it would be tough. I do think there would be an avenue because I think there are hospitals in underserved areas which don't have those criteria, and I'm sure they'd be happy to have me. But let's be honest, Joe, I'm not going back. I mean, I'm done. I cannot. There's no way I could walk into a hospital. There's no way I could have discussions or lecture honestly about, I've just learned too much. I've learned too much about pharmaceutical control of almost all of the medical evidence. I mean, you start with, you know, statins, SSRIs, you know, we lived through a drug called Zygris, which is a massive corruption in critical care for years. And then the corruptions around, you know, Paxlovid and ivermectin. I mean, there's no way I can fit. I'm like, now I'm a square peg in a round hole. So to be honest, I don't think it would have impact because I am also now in private practice as well. You know, I have a kind of a bustling telehealth practice. And I'm very happy. I'm outside the system. I can do and say and care for the patients in a manner that I best see fit. And so I think for Peter, maybe he may go into private practice as well outside of a system. So anyway, but yeah, so what happened with that, and this is kind of interesting, is the way which we replied was different than Peter. So Peter replied in the way that I thought I was going to, which was he basically just presented all the evidence to support all the statements that they accused him of as being misinformation, very data-driven, evidence-based. What we did is our lawyer looked at their policy on misinformation and the process of, let's call it convicting someone as a misinformationist required that they provide us the evidence showing that we are wrong and misinformed. But the letter to us was bizarre. It was this hodgepodge of statements that I'd made or written on my Substack. And it was just implied that that's a misinformation. And at the end, they just said, we expect a response letter in 45 days. A committee will meet and review and a decision on disciplinary action will be made. And so we just wrote back very simply. We said, excuse us, but your letter does not follow your own misinformation policy. We ask that you kindly reissue the letter with the evidence showing that we're wrong. And we've gotten radio silence ever since.
So turned it around on them. Wow, that's great. Brilliant. Smart lawyer.
Say that again?
Smart lawyer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's great. He's a lawyer that's been, his specialty is actually defending and supporting like naturopaths, alternative medicine doctors, you know, because I mean, the boards and the system has been after those docs for a long time. So he is, you know, chronic Lyme specialists, things like that. And so he knows what he's doing.
Terrific. So they haven't gotten back to you and it looks like that might be a successful strategy for you.
Well, yeah, I wonder if they're going to sign someone to issue that letter or they're just, or, you know, probably, Joe, what they're going to do is they're probably still going to have their meeting. They're going to look at our response and they're going to say, you're done. I don't know, you know. Yeah. And then the other saddest thing, Joe, is that this will not impact Paul at all because his career is over. He doesn't.
He's in retirement phase.
He doesn't practice clinical medicine anymore. I mean, he was an intensivist, a pure intensivist. That's all he did. And he would never go back into an ICU now. And he's one of the greatest critical care doctors in history, if not the greatest.
Yeah, well, I'm sad to see that, but in a sad way to end his career. But for in your case, it's really interesting because what you were doing in critical care medicine is sort of the epitome of intensive care. There's no question. And you took a pretty significant, almost 180 degree turn to go to almost primary care medicine.
Yep.
And keep people out of that scenario, which is what I concluded when I had the choices we all do was we're finishing our medical studies as to what specialty we're going to go in. I was torn at the time between internal medicine and family medicine. And I realized I do not want to spend time in the hospital. My purpose is to keep people out of the hospital. So, I mean, obviously not everyone.
Joe, can I comment on that? Because what you just said is really important to me. Yeah. Because you know, I went into critical care because it was really like high level adrenaline. I found the physiology and the organ failures and trying to maintain and juggle multiple organ failures at one time to be highly intellectually stimulating and intellectually satisfying when you save someone. But you're absolutely right. You know, all of those years that I spent teaching, I mean, I'm directing my care at really, you know, those final chapters in someone's life. And even, I will tell you, I've had amazing successes where I was able to return someone who was deathly ill to full functional status. But that was not the norm. Most people were elderly, frail, multiple comorbidities. And even when they survived the ICU, they basically progressed into months of, you know, either rehab or what I call chronic critical care, which is repeated episodes of sepsis. And so that part wasn't very satisfying. And now, you're absolutely right. Now I treat complex chronic illnesses. My specialty now that I'm really interested in is figuring out this long haul and post-vaccine injury syndromes. Now there, we collaborate with doctors who've been doing that for decades, you know, with chronic Lyme and fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, which are wickedly difficult to treat and understand. And so like, I kind of have a new, not only career and practice, but a new intellectual focus. And you're absolutely right. It's much more satisfying. I mean, I'm literally returning people to levels of function that they weren't at before. I mean, patients come to me, I use, you know, random percentages, but at like 20% of their former function. You know, these were oftentimes healthy, full careers, children, exercised, ate right. And now they're fully disabled with numerous organ system complaints. And I'll tell you, getting them from 20 to 40 is a big deal. You know, like when they can actually do like just a little bit more than they were doing before. And, you know, and when you get them to 80, it's transformative. I totally agree with you. Like, I don't regret my career. I think I taught, you know, because I will tell you, ICU is really it's almost like a classroom. Everybody who comes through there, we teach a lot of physiology. Like I taught, you know, a generation of physicians who went into other specialties. And I think that what they learned about the physiology, the approach, the thought processes that we had to use and the judgment we had to use, I think that part I'm proud of. I think I was integral in training doctors. But you're right, the impacts on patients are nothing like it is in keeping them out of the hospital, right?
And it's just shifting of your skill set to a different intellectual challenge. My view is it potentially even more challenging
because I totally
the complexities that are there. I mean, at end stage, I mean, there's a lot of commonalities that make it pretty cut and dried. But when you have at the level you're tackling now, there's so many variables that contribute to it. It's a real detective challenge for sure.
And the thing is you're absolutely right. It's way more challenging. I'm so humbled. And I tell my patients, you know, I say, listen, I have to be humble here. I'm trying to figure this out. I'm collaborating. I'm reading. I'm learning from you. I'm learning from each patient, you know, because we're doing a lot of empiric therapies, right? We're trying things. And so I learn, you know, each patient serves as their own control. And I'm finding different things work in different patients. But the real challenge that I'm finding, Joe, is that I don't have any biomarkers or tests, which I find helpful to direct therapies. You know, a lot of the tests are normal. You know, even inflammatory markers, clotting markers are normal. And yet I know that they have inflammatory processes and they're, you know, thrombogenic. And so it's, you know, I wish there was more research and guidance in these diseases.
Agree. Well, I want to dive into that in a little bit, then we can go into your book. But before I do that, I wanted to share an interesting memory I had. And, you know, in light of the fact that they're coming after the three of you, you know, I was wondering, why didn't the Illinois Medical Board come after me for my license for misinformation? Well, they in some ways they did. They called me up and asked me a bunch of questions. I don't know when, and last at least a year ago, maybe longer. And then I remember that's the same medical board that sought to take my license away about 10 or 15 years ago when I published a review and wrote an article about how useless mammography was. And in fact, it was worse than useless. It probably contributed to increasing cancers. Now, they had some people write in complaints. No one suffered or died as a result of the article I wrote, but they were they wanted to take me out. So they were going to discipline my license and potentially even take it away. And I said, no, you're not. So I wound up suing them in the state Supreme Court, and we won based on First Amendment principles. So they may have remembered that you know, I wasn't going to go down easy.
And Joe, it goes without saying that your article was absolutely evidence-based with a lot of data to form that conclusion and that recommendation. And it was science.
Yeah.
But it's inconvenient science because there's a whole system of mammography that's embedded into our health system, right? And so I get it.
Yeah. So anyway, that brought back some good memories. But I want to dive into your treatment protocols and suggest that the reason that most of the, it seems like the primary complaint most of the people that are presenting to you with long haul COVID would be fatigue or tired,
yes,
not enough energy. So you have to go back and to physiology and remember, well, what generates 90% of the energy of your body? It's your mitochondria. So most likely this lack of fatigue and energy is a result of inefficient energy production, impaired energy production in the mitochondria, or more simply mitochondrial dysfunction.
100%.
Yeah. So the challenge is how to recover it. I'm going to suggest a few things. In fact, maybe we can even discuss after we finish this, you know, some potential collaboration, because I think I've got some ideas that might radically improve your results. And if you're getting the results, you have the platform and the clinical credibility to spread this even more widely, because I don't have an opportunity to treat patients directly. So I would love to have the opportunity to treat them indirectly.
Well, here's the thing, Joe. We have a group that we collaborate with. Like on our protocols, we had, you know, several meetings. We got input from a lot of folks, like, you know, like Merrill Nass, JP Salimi.
No one invited me.
And that's the thing. I want to invite you to our next meeting. I'd love to hear you, because I will tell you that protocol, it's really not a protocol because it's not really structured as one, but it's really a list of things that we have found effective, and how you deploy and apply them and in what sequence, it's really up to the practitioner. I mean, we don't have a rigid approach and it's meant to be an evolution. We're constantly adding, tweaking, you know, putting things to consider. But the mitochondrial recovery, that's a topic and a target that I'm listening, I'm learning, you know.
Yeah, I'm actually in the process of writing my next book on that. So, and it should be out. Well, I should finish it this year, but I'm about halfway through it. And so it's really hot in my mind right now. But anyway, I would be really intrigued. I don't know if anyone's brought this to your attention before, but this is the oldest drug in the world. This is the only drug I embrace. Do you know what the oldest drug in the world is? At least the modern world. It was a textile dye invented in Germany in 1876.
Methylene blue?
Methylene blue. That's
right. Yeah, my really sick patients were using methylene blue because, you know, some of the really sick ones that aren't responding to medicine, we do send them from, you know, I send them to a clinic where they do, you know, apheresis, ozone, methylene blue, infrared.
Oh, nice. That's really good.
One of them actually was discharged on oral methylene blue. And so my interest is really, I want to figure out how to implement oral methylene blue.
I don't recommend it IV. The only indication for IV and methylene blue is if the person's dying of like a cyanide overdose, where you've got to get in there quickly. But no, I mean, oral has more than sufficient absorption. There's really no difference except for the rapidity at which it gets in. So typically 30, 40, 50 milligrams of the powder, you know, taken once or twice in divided doses, should be pretty dramatic. And the beautiful thing about this is that the energy recovery is typically within hours. So because it increases the ability of the mitochondria to produce ATP about 30% in electron transport chain. So,
well, Joe, and you got
it's not that treating the foundational cause, but if you give them more energy, they're able to be more compliant with the other.
And see, that's the importance that, like, I think of mitochondrial recovery. It's really one component because there are other processes that are actually impacting the mitochondria. And so interrupting those processes, whether it be you know, hypoperfusion from microclotting, or, you know, these unrelenting inflammatory, the monocytes and macrophages are activated. Because I will tell you, when I treat those processes, I see tremendous recoveries in some patients, in some. And that's the other thing that's so humbling is, like, I'll have two patients, let's say in vaccine injury, who present with very similar clinical presentations. Drug A and B work like gangbusters in patient A and do very little in patient B. And you know, when we talk about the protocol, like, we've kind of, like, this elaborated so far on about six or seven different pathophysiologic mechanisms, and one of them is mitochondrial dysfunction. But I don't know which is the predominant one in each patient.
Yeah,
I have no way of figuring that out. And the only way I figured out is by responses to therapy. Like, for instance, I had one young woman recently. She was, I think she was a long hauler. I mean, there's a lot of overlap to the two syndromes, but I tried a number of trials of therapy. And you know what resurrected her finally when I started to treat mast cell activation? You know, I put her on antihistamine, famotidine, you know, ketotifen, and boom.
How about quercetin?
Quercetin is tricky for me, and maybe you can educate me. Like, the problem with quercetin is it's so poorly bioavailable, and really the trials that seem to work, it's a specific formulation, you know, like it's either phytosomal or liposomal. And I, you know, and so many patients come to me already on quercetin. I think they're just not on the right dose and not the right formulation, but it can be it is purportedly a good mast cell stabilizer. I just clinically get better responses with other drugs, but again, maybe I'm not.
Well, it's not a drug. Quercetin's not a drug.
Well, yeah, there you go. Okay, with other therapies, let's say.
Yeah. But one of the things you can do is simple. I don't think they make it, but it's easy to make yourself, is to do a quercetin suppository, because then you're going from oral to transmucosal, which has a much higher absorption and less metabolic byproducts shifted to it. So it doesn't get methylated or detoxified as easily. But one of the things I don't know if you've done, the ability to do it is going to be progressively decreasing in the coming months, but it doesn't cost anything. And it's totally natural, is to get your patients into the sun for an hour a day, preferably around solar noon. And the reason that's so effective, obviously for vitamin D, but perhaps even more so in the case of the mitochondria, is that the near infrared. Yeah, specifically, it was about 40% of the sunlight, and it increases the melatonin. The melatonin increases right in the mitochondria, so you radically reduce reactive oxygen species and secondarily increase the efficiency of ATP.
I will tell you, I just, so we have been recommending that.
Yes.
And I will tell you, I had just like 10 days ago, I had my first kind of really robust clinical response from someone who actually employed that without me telling them. But my patient, who was still struggling, she said, you know, a few weeks ago, I go out, you know, around sunrise, and I'm out there in the sun. I relax for an hour a day. And she found it to be extremely helpful at mitigating her symptoms. And so, no, you're spot on.
Sunrise is a different time of day. You're not going to get the near infrared intensity to cause that mitochondrial. And you've got to have minimal clothing on, too. It's not going to work if you go out with long sleeve shirt pants. Just not. So you need the radiation on your skin. It's free. I mean, you don't have to do. I mean, you don't have to just sit there and do nothing. You could read.
Can you package that in a pill, Joe, and charge a lot of money? Then what use is it?
Yeah, it's pretty.
Sorry
it's
for
pretty
my amazing. Cynicism.
No, I know. In a commercial sense, that's correct. But you know, I've been enormously impressed with my clinical career to just providing people with solid, basic lifestyle changes. And once they integrate them, it makes all your other recommendations so much easier, because you're coming on a higher level of health, and you change the physiology to a condition where they're much more likely to respond.
There's no question. And your work and your experience in doing that has never been more important than now, because that's one of the things that I when I talk now in interviews, you know, when we talk about our work in the FLCCC, we're trying to give patients more agency over their health, because, you know, going to the system and following system recommendations, again, it's so corrupted by pharma, and they're not, those treatments are not really interested in getting you better. You're not a good customer if you're healthy, right? And so, you know, and I don't know that I believe that as much as I do now. I mean, I always had my suspicions that all was not, you know, patient-centered in my career, but now I see very little that's patient-centered, to be honest. You're absolutely right. Giving patients, you know, agency and approaches in order to preserve and improve their health is immensely satisfying.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the Flexner Report, which was catalyzed by Rockefeller and Carnegie in 1910 and funded by it. But it was really the foundation that led to the removal of all this type of information from the medical school curriculum. It was essentially ousted 110 years ago, gone. You know, never be put back in.
I didn't understand that history until recently. And when you read about it, I mean, they literally, natural remedies were, you know, quacks, and, you know, they went after osteopaths and chiropractors and everything. And they just wanted petroleum-based pharmaceuticals were the, you know, rule of the land. And it's stunning. It's stunning.
And many people today don't know that Rockefeller owns 50% of the drug companies. You know, by percent, not directly 100%, but the percentages that they're owned is about half. Half. So it was a pretty clever and actually brilliant business strategy.
It was formidable what he achieved. I mean, you know, I just came across this little data point the other day that in Marsha, I think you pronounce her last name, Angel or Angle, former editor of New England
Journal, right?
Yeah. And you know, and she left as editor because she progressively got disgusted with the corruption and influence.
She wrote a book too. Wow.
Yeah, she wrote a book. And in that book, Joe, she writes that in 2001, among the Fortune 500 companies, the top 10 pharmaceutical companies had more profits than the rest of the Fortune 500 combined.
Yeah. And you know what else is really impressive about that? Many people who aren't in the medical field like we are would not appreciate this necessarily, is that the New England Journal of Medicine is the highest impact journal in the entire world. It's number one. And she was the editor for almost a decade, maybe longer. I don't know. Can't recall. But having her say that, the editor of the most prestigious medical journal of all in the world, to say that is extraordinary.
And absolutely. Like, that's the other transformation, Joe, that Paul and I have undergone. I think me more so than Paul is that we really looked to those journals thinking that they were, you know, the most sophisticated and that was the top levels of science. And seeing what was published in those journals throughout COVID has uncovered just the absolute control by the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, what appears in those journals is what they allow to appear in those journals. Period. I know of many positive studies of repurposed drugs rejected. And even worse, we've seen them pull the following, like JAMA and New England Journal both. Instead of rejecting, they hold on to it as if they're considering it, sometimes for months. And then the rejection comes months later. Never heard of that in my career. I mean, usually when I've tried to submit manuscripts, they either say, this is interesting, we're sending it out for peer review, or they say, this is not of sufficient interest to our readership at this time. And they were literally rejecting positive trials of ivermectin. And then probably the greatest and most saddening corruption that they pulled is that they published the Together trial on ivermectin, the one down in Brazil, which is so brazenly fraudulent and corrupt. And there's so much documented actions that those investigators took in order to ensure that they did not have a statistically significant benefit for ivermectin. And yet the New England Journal of Medicine published it. And when you look at the design and the conduct of the trial, it should never be published. It was so brazenly corrupt. And the investigators were all working for either their own companies or other companies whose sole job was to do research contracts for pharmaceutical companies. I mean, what would happen to their careers, Joe, had they published a positive trial in ivermectin? That's it. Bye. No more contracts.
So this is a good segue into your book, The War on Ivermectin, which comes out in October. I think we hope.
I have to be honest. We're just at the end. I think I'm submitting. We think
draft first
final draft this week, and then I hope it's probably going to be mid to late October. But yeah, it's coming. I've blown a lot of
Halloween time. Halloween.
Yeah, let's call it Halloween. Yeah. it's a scary book for sure, to be honest. It really is. You know, I mean,
why is it a scary book? Before you answer that, there's two, I guess, not pioneers, but people you think of when you talk about ivermectin. There's you and Tess Lori.
Yeah.
So, and obviously she's not a clinician. You are. So, you know, I'm so glad you wrote a book on this.
Yeah.
So why is your book scary?
Because, it details, I mean, so the theme of the book is really centered around an article called The Disinformation Playbook, which is published on the website of the Union for Concerned Scientists. And, you know, what happened, Joe, is after my ivermectin testimony, right, which went viral, which brought a lot of attention to the FLCCC, our work.
Which testimony was this?
So this was December 8th of 2020. You know, I testified in a hearing, I was invited by Senator Ron Johnson. On early treatment. And, you know, Peter and I think it was Harvey presented the week before on hydroxychloroquine, and boy, did they get attacked. I mean, New York Times, you know, they called Senator Johnson the snake oil salesman of the Senate. You know, I mean, it was fearsome, the attacks they endured. When I testified a week later on the importance and the incredible data supporting ivermectin, the video went viral and it got a lot of attention. And suddenly our organization got a lot of attention. Our protocols were looked into. Doctors started prescribing ivermectin. And, you know, I thought, this is how naive I was, Joe, I literally thought that, like, we were providing a solution, if not a solution, a major intervention that would alter the trajectory of the pandemic without question. It would reduce cases and deaths and hospitalizations. And now you had an effective early outpatient treatment. And I thought that news would be welcome. I didn't think there was going to be a ticker tape parade necessarily, or maybe I did. That was one possibility. I thought maybe, you know, we would, you know, the FLCCC would come out as heroes. And really it was Paul who identified the data. You know, I always have to say that it was really Paul that identified the data signal first. He said, wow, you got to see what these studies are starting to show. And I jumped in right behind him. I was the first author of that comprehensive review paper. I worked a lot and I got deeply expert on ivermectin. But what happened in the next few months is that, like, everything started going sideways and I could not figure it out. I saw hit pieces. And I mean, to you, this is not news. You're probably like, yep, I've seen that before.
Predictable, highly predictable.
Entirely predictable. And the thing is, I didn't know, like, I'll tell you how little I knew. I didn't know that what I was really doing, I only learned that as a retrospect, is I was literally bringing forth data supporting the efficacy of a generic drug. Now, that is poking the bear. And when we, you know, when I say poking the bear, what is anathema to the pharmaceutical industry and their whole business model is they cannot have generic off-patent drugs become standard of care. It obliterates the market for their pricey new pills. And I didn't know I was stepping into a war.
Well, it's even worse than that. Yes, that was true, but you impacted the potential possibility that this intervention could remove the emergency use authorization for these
jabs.